stand by. Your meeting is ready to begin. Please be advised that this conference call is being recorded. Good afternoon and welcome to the Manulife Financial Q3 2010 financial results for November 4th, 2010. Your host for today will be Mr. Anthony Oster, Senior Vice President of Investor Relations. Mr. Oster, please go ahead.
Thank you and good afternoon. Welcome to Manulife's conference call to discuss our third quarter 2010 financial and operating results. Today's call will reference our earnings announcement, statistical package, and webcast slides, which are available in the Investor Relations section of our website at manulife.com. As in prior quarters, our executives will be making some introductory comments. We will then follow with a question and answer session. Today's speakers may make forward-looking statements within the meaning of securities legislation. Certain material factors or assumptions are applied in making forward-looking statements, and actual results may differ materially from those expressed or implied. For additional information about the material factors or assumptions applied and about the material factors that may cause actual results to differ, please consult the slide presentation for this conference call and webcast available on our website, as well as securities filings referred to in the slide entitled Caution Regarding Forward-Looking Statements. When we reach the question and answer portion of our conference call, we would ask each participant to adhere to a limit of one or two questions. If you have additional questions, please re-queue as we will do our best to respond to all questions. With that, I'd like to turn the call over to Donald Galloyne, our President and Chief Executive Officer. Donald.
Thank you, Anthony. Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us today. Our third quarter 2010 financial results announced this morning reflect a quarter in which we made considerable headway executing our business plan, both in terms of repositioning our business, reducing our equity and interest rate sensitivities. I'm joined on the call today by our CFO, Michael Bell, as well as several members of our senior management team, including our U.S. General Manager, Jim Boyle, Canadian General Manager, Paul Rooney, Warren Thompson for Investments, and our talented finance team. Let me start with my assessment of our progress this quarter. We had a net loss attributed to shareholders of $947 million, equating to a fully diluted loss per share of 55 cents. Despite the reported results, it's important to note that we generated strong underlying earnings from operations. Adjusted earnings from operations were $779 million in the quarter, within the $700 to $800 million range we estimated for fiscal 2010, in our 2009 annual report. The operational contributions were more than offset by a $2 billion reserve strengthening and a $1 billion goodwill impairment related to the current economic climate and the repositioning of our U.S. business. Manulife's capital position remains strong. In the quarter, Manulife increased its MCCSR ratio to 234%. We achieved a 19% reduction in interest rate income sensitivity by lengthening the duration of our fixed income investments through swaps and other initiatives in both the liability and the surplus segments. Furthermore, we reduced equity exposure by hedging an additional $3.3 billion of in-force variable annuity guaranteed value and also lowered our equity holdings by almost $450 million. With the actions taken, the total amount of guaranteed value hedged or reinsured was 54% as at September 30th. As you've seen in our press release, we've adopted revised targets for hedging both interest rates and equities. Fortunately, equity markets have moved once again in our favor. The S&P 500 is almost up almost 20% since the July 2 low, and in fact, it's pretty much on the yearly high. We also hedged another $800 million just today. Our goal is to execute additional hedges so that approximately 60% of our underlying earnings sensitivity to equity market movements is hedged by the end of 2012. You'll note that this is a more relevant standard than the notional standard we used before, the 70% notional amount hedged. Now we're using a standard of earnings sensitivity, and the goal is to have 60% hedged by the end of 2012. And to go further than that through to 2014. We plan to use a combination of macro and dynamic hedging and other techniques until we are well within our targets. With the basis changes and interest rate moves in the quarter, our interest rate sensitivity was going to increase beyond levels that we would find tolerable. In addition, the outlook seems to be for lower rates for a longer period of time. As a result, we are arranging our fares so that we do not expect to see an increase in interest sensitivity, and through a variety of measures, plan to decrease that sensitivity over the next 4 years. To the extent rates continue to decline, we would also expect to generate additional gains on sale of bonds in surplus. During the quarter, we saw positive results globally from our efforts to reallocate capital and resources to those products targeted for growth. Our repositioning is indeed working. In Asia, for example, sales of insurance products increased 50%, 50%. I'm also particularly proud of our U.S. business, where adjusted earnings from operations increased 72% over the third quarter of 2009. This was driven by reducing strain, changing product mix, and price changes. In Canada, mutual fund sales increased 181%, with deposits almost triple 2009 levels. Manulife Bank sales increased by 13% year over year, and life insurance sales were up 11% in individual insurance. And in fact, as of last night, our U.S. mutual fund business recorded $8 billion in sales year to date. Our credit experience remains strong, which is a reflection of the continued strength of our investment division. Now, we know a number of analysts like to compare our results with those of our U.S. peers on the basis of earnings and shareholders' equity. Under U.S. GAAP, we're estimating that we'll report a net loss of $212 million, which is approximately $700 million lower than that recorded under Canadian GAAP. In addition, our total equity is about $9 billion difference. During the quarter, we also added to the highly successful John Hancock brand campaign in the United States by launching campaigns to tell our stories to Asian and Canadian audiences. These investments are helping to grow the value of our global brand. In summary, we are successfully reducing our equity and interest rate sensitivities, also positioning our business for future earnings growth and ROE expansion. I'm also pleased to say that Manulife's board recently had a board meeting in China where we met with our many wonderful partners in China, signifying the strategic importance of Asia to Manulife's future plans. At that time, the board also reviewed and reaffirmed its support of the company's strategic direction and plans. We are enormously pleased to be able to share those plans with you at an Investor Day planned for November 19th. With that, I'll turn the podium over to Michael Bell, who will highlight our financial results and then open the call to your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Donald. Hello, everybody. Today we reported a third quarter shareholders' net loss of $947 million, which equates to a loss of 55 cents per share on a fully diluted basis. I'll first refer to slide 7, which provides a summary of the quarter's results. Excluding notable items, our adjusted earnings from operations were $779 million and at the upper end of our previously stated range, and we view these underlying business results to be strong. We completed our annual review of actuarial methods and assumptions in the third quarter, and this resulted in a total net charge of just over $2 billion after tax, and I'll review these items in a few minutes. On a Canadian GAAP basis, we recorded an impairment of goodwill of just over $1 billion related to our revised outlook for our U.S. insurance business. This review of goodwill was necessitated by current economic conditions and our recent decisions to reposition that business. And as we've discussed, this goodwill impairment is a non-cash item which does not impact regulatory capital. During the quarter, we took important fixed income investment actions, which reduced our sensitivity to interest rate changes and increased our capital levels. We ended the third quarter with a strong capital position as MLI's MCCSR was 234% at September 30th, up 13 points from last quarter, despite the impact of the annual actuarial basis changes. We also did a good job continuing to generate strong top-line growth in our targeted growth areas while effectively limiting sales of our other products by design. Our credit performance continued to be strong, which is a testament to our investment discipline. We also significantly reduced our interest rate sensitivity, and we have plans to continue to reduce both interest rate and equity market exposures over the medium term. And we expect to report a net loss of $212 million on a U.S. GAAP basis in the third quarter. And this result continued to be better than our CGAAP net result, even though the U.S. GAAP result includes a larger goodwill impairment. So overall, we're pleased with our progress on several key priorities in the quarter, although obviously not satisfied with our net income result. Now let's move to slide 8, which provides a breakdown of the notable items in the quarter. Note that the net impact of third quarter's higher equity markets and lower interest rates totaled approximately $1 billion after tax. This included $569 million of realized gains on the sale of bonds in our surplus segment. These bonds were sold to offset some of the negative impact of the decline in interest rates on the policy liabilities since the beginning of the year, and therefore served as an important partial hedge. We generated additional investment gains in the liability segments, including the impact of actions to lengthen the duration of our fixed income investments, which support our policy liabilities. We feel positive that these actions contributed to two objectives. They increased our capital and reduced our interest rate sensitivity. And as noted on the slide, these additional favorable investment-related gains contributed $364 million in earnings. So excluding the notable items, adjusted earnings from operations in the third quarter totaled $779 million, which we view as a positive result. Slide 9 summarizes our results by division, and we've excluded the impact of the equity markets, interest rates, and investment results. So excluding the substantial losses in corporate for the annual basis change and the goodwill impairment, the divisional results were up materially versus the first half of the year. Our U.S. insurance business demonstrated the most improvement in underlying earnings as price increases and lower volumes drove a substantial improvement in new business strain. Improved policyholder experience contributed as well. In addition, we drove underlying earnings growth in the U.S. wealth management business primarily through a more favorable sales mix. In Canada, underlying earnings growth versus the prior quarter was driven by improved claims and lapse experience. The Asia division experienced a decline versus the prior quarter, primarily due to lower new business gains in Japan. So overall, we're pleased with the underlying trends in the divisional results. Turning now to slide 10, our source of earnings. Expected profit on in-force was in line with the prior year. On a currency-adjusted basis, the $930 million result was the best in the last five quarters, despite the additional earnings headwind from hedging more in-force variable annuity business. New business strain improved primarily due to the better U.S. results that I mentioned on the prior slide. The net experience gain primarily reflected the higher equity markets and investment gains, which more than offset the impact of lower interest rates. Management actions and basis change of $3.1 billion pre-tax is largely comprised of the annual actuarial basis change and the goodwill impairment charges, partially offset by the realized gains on the AFS bonds. Now, slide 11 summarizes our regulatory capital position for MLI. The actions that we've taken over the last 12 months to increase capital and to reduce our market exposures have strengthened our company's overall position. MLI reported an MCCSR of 234% for September 30th, a sequential increase of 13 points despite the $2 billion impact of the actuarial basis change. The debt proceeds raised in the third quarter and deployed to MLI contributed to this increase. Our strong investment gains, adjusted earnings from operations, and the positive impact of equity markets also increased the capital ratio. The goodwill impairment charge did not impact this ratio, as goodwill is excluded from MLI's regulatory capital calculation. Now, slide 12 provides an updated estimate of earnings and capital sensitivities for equity markets and interest rates. As we've discussed before, these are high-level directional estimates based upon changes to a single factor. While we disclose these sensitivities to provide some general direction, In reality, several factors change in the same quarter, and no simple formula can model the earnings impact in any given quarter with precision. The main highlight on this slide is that the actions that we took in the quarter significantly reduced our earnings sensitivity to interest rates to $2.2 billion for a 100 basis point parallel decline versus $2.7 billion sensitivity last quarter. So in other words, the lengthening of the duration of our assets more than offset the impact on the sensitivity from the annual basis change and the third quarter decline in interest rates. Now, the equity market sensitivity did not change materially from the prior quarter due to the impact of the basis change offsetting the combined impact of the sale of the surplus equities, increased hedging, and equity market appreciation. I would note that the MCCSR sensitivities did improve relative to June 30th. Slide 13 details the impact of equity markets on our results in the third quarter. As noted, equity markets generally performed very well, although the TOPIX was down 1.3%. We estimate that the combined impact of the positive equity market performance and variable annuity hedging program resulted in a net positive benefit of $683 million. Of this amount, we had gains of $700 million for the unhedged VA business, which were partially offset by a loss on the hedged VA block due to higher realized volatility and some unhedged elements of the program. On slide 14, you can see that during the quarter, we reduced our equity exposure by hedging an additional $3.3 billion of in-force variable annuity guaranteed value. As a result, the total notional amount of guaranteed value hedged or reinsured was 54% on September 30th. We also sold a significant amount of our equity holdings in our surplus segment, which generated gains and reduced our overall equity sensitivity. And as noted in our press release, we've now established a goal of executing additional hedges so that 60% of our underlying earnings sensitivity to equity market movements is hedged by the end of 2012, and approximately 75% is hedged by the end of 2014 through a combination of time-scheduled and market-based actions. Now, there are two important messages in this sentence that I'd like to reinforce. First, we do intend to implement time-scheduled triggers to supplement our current market-based triggers so that the planned reduction in our equity market sensitivity is not market-dependent. Second, we intend to transition to our equity market's earnings sensitivity as our primary measure to describe how much we've hedged rather than the 54% of notional guaranteed value hedged. Our updated plan would entail a larger reduction in earnings sensitivity than the impact of the original plan to hedge 70% of the notional guaranteed value by year-end 2012. So by 2012, we intend to hedge a minimum of 70% of our overall VA earnings sensitivity and 60% of our company-wide earnings sensitivity to equity markets. Overall, our intention is a more certain glide path and a lower earnings sensitivity to equity markets relative to our original plan. Now moving to slide 15. Under Canadian GAAP, changes in interest rates impact the actuarial valuation of in-force policies by changing the returns assumed on the investment of net future cash flows. During the quarter, both Treasury and corporate bond rates declined and long swap spreads decreased, which resulted in an overall impact of approximately $360 million after tax, including the impact of the actions that we took during the quarter to reduce the sensitivity. Now turning to slide 16, after the basis change, we're now grading to long-term average corporate bond spreads. As a result, interest rates and corporate spreads across the curve in the U.S., Canada, and Asia are expected to influence reserves. The predominant influence is long U.S. interest rates and long U.S. corporate spreads, but the complexity of the calculations means that no simple formula can estimate the results accurately. In addition, our corporate valuation spreads eliminate outliers to be more representative of our investable universe, which typically dampens our volatility to spread changes. Our estimated sensitivities as of September 30th include the following. for a parallel 100 basis point drop in all interest rates, we would expect to incur a $2.2 billion reduction in shareholders' net income. For a 50 basis point drop in corporate spreads, we'd expect to incur a reduction in net income of $600 million. And for a 20 basis point increase in swap spreads, we would expect to see a reduction of $200 million after tax. These estimated impacts on earnings are based on the September 30th starting point and the business mix at that date. Actual results may differ materially from these estimates for a variety of reasons, including additional management actions, the interaction between multiple factors, and a variety of other variables. In addition, please note that there is an incremental potential material impact of a future changes in our ultimate reinvestment rate used to calculate reserves if government bond rates remain near the current rates, as our URR is based on a 10-year weighted rolling average of government bond rates and will continue to be updated in the future. Now, slide 17 details the actions we took, which reduced our net income sensitivity to interest rates by 19%. We're pleased with the progress that we made this quarter and plan to take further actions to reduce our interest rate exposure as measured by the impact on shareholders' net income by a minimum of 25% by year-end 2012 and by 50% by the end of 2014. In addition, as noted in our disclosures, our economic sensitivity is lower than our earnings sensitivity due to the embedded partial hedge from our long-duration surplus bonds. Now, as noted on slide 18, we completed our annual review of all actuarial assumptions in the third quarter, resulting in a total net charge of just over $2 billion on an after-tax basis. We completed our comprehensive long-term care claims experience study, which including estimating favorable impacts of in-force rate increases. This resulted in an after-tax impact of $755 million. Within this calculation, expected future in-force premium increases reduced this charge by $2.2 billion pre-tax, resulting in a total of $3 billion pre-tax of future premium increases now assumed in the current reserves. Premium increases averaging approximately 40% will be sought on approximately 80% of our in-force business. And we've made assumptions on our ability and timing of obtaining price increases, although actual results could be materially different. We expect that our actual experience in this area would result in updated assumptions over time, which could be material to net income. Now, as part of our annual review, equity volatility parameters and expected bond returns for variable annuities were updated. In aggregate, these updated assumptions totaled $665 million in terms of their impact on net income. Changes to the ultimate reinvestment rates and fixed income spread grading contributed to an after-tax charge of $309 million. Liabilities were increased by $485 million on an after-tax basis to reflect experience on policyholder behavior, including strengthening related to emerging recent lower lapse experience on U.S. and Canadian variable annuity contracts that are in the money. Now, as you'll note on slide 19, our goodwill review was accelerated this quarter due to the updated outlook for our U.S. insurance business. This resulted in approximately $1 billion goodwill impact under Canadian GAAP while not impacting our MCCSR. In addition, as noted in our 2009 annual report and this year's disclosures, the adoption of IFRS Phase 1 will result in additional testing of goodwill, which will be at a more granular level than under Canadian GAAP. Our preliminary estimate is that this could result in an additional $2.2 billion goodwill impairment for a total impact of $3.2 billion, and we expect to complete this analysis in the fourth quarter. In the meantime, our U.S. GAAP goodwill impairment this quarter was greater than the CGAAP charge previously noted, and it is estimated to total approximately $2.6 billion. This is attributable primarily to a higher book value of our business on a U.S. GAAP basis relative to the CGAAP basis. I'll now turn to slide 20, which shows that our fixed income portfolio continued to perform very well relative to overall market conditions. Impairments and downgrades were modestly better than the long-term expected credit losses assumed in the valuation of policy liabilities. So overall, we continue to be pleased with our portfolio's results. Slide 21 looks at the portfolio, and it shows that it continues to be a high quality and well-diversified. 95% of our bonds are investment grade, and our invested assets are highly diversified by geography and sector, with limited exposure to the high-risk areas noted on the slide. Turning now to our top-line results, on slide 22, you can see the strong insurance sales results. Insurance sales on targeted growth products grew by 24% over the prior year on a constant currency basis. This would suggest an increase in sales market share for these targeted growth products. In addition, overall wealth sales for targeted growth products grew by 11% over the prior year on the same basis. And we view this as good execution in both of these areas. We also took measured actions to increase prices on new business for various products to better reflect current economic conditions and outlook. Specifically, prices on universal life, no lapse guarantee products in the U.S. will be increased by 13% on average. In Canada, universal life products will be increased on average by approximately 10% in December. And pricing for our long-term care new business will be increased by an average of 24% over 2010 and early 2011. And these actions are expected to improve our financial results and help us shift our business mix. On slide 23, you can see that the Asia division delivered record sales in the third quarter, increasing 50% over the prior year. Of particular note, Japan insurance sales doubled prior year levels on the continued success of new product launches across several distribution channels. In addition, record sales were achieved in Hong Kong and Taiwan. In Canada, individual life insurance sales were up 11% over the prior year. And in the U.S., good progress is being made on our product repositioning efforts, as evidenced by the fact that our universal life sales, excluding the universal life no lapse guarantee product, grew by 20% on the strength of our new products. Now turn to slide 24, which shows that our plans include growth for our non-guaranteed wealth products. Asia division experienced impressive growth, with overall wealth sales excluding variable annuities up 63% over the prior year on a constant currency basis. We're also pleased with the results of our U.S. wealth management business. Sales of John Hancock Mutual Funds increased 26% in the quarter and 55% year-to-date versus the prior year, attributable to a broad, diversified offering of competitive funds distributed through the retail, institutional, and defined contribution channels, as well as we got some benefit from improved market conditions. Year-to-date sales in 2010 have already exceeded full year 2009 and are on pace for a record year. In addition, retirement plan sales ended the third quarter with funds under management at record levels. These results are encouraging signs that our focused product repositioning efforts in the U.S. are working. In addition, Canada experienced excellent progress as part of our broader sales growth and diversification strategy, as evidenced by an impressive increase in Manulife mutual fund deposits, which were almost triple 2009 levels. Slide 25 shows the growth in new business embedded value for our targeted growth products. New business embedded value for the insurance businesses that we're targeting to grow increased by 10% in the third quarter, reflecting strong growth in Asia and Canada, which was offset by the effect of lower interest rates on the John Hancock Life Insurance business. New business embedded value on wealth products, excluding variable annuities and the U.S. book value fixed deferred annuities, increased 6% over the third quarter of 2009. New business embedded value for insurance and wealth products that we're not targeting for growth decreased substantially, reflecting lower sales volume. As shown on slide 26, total funds under management on September 30th were $474 billion, representing an increase of $20 billion over last quarter. Now, similar to last quarter, I think it's important to address key questions that you're likely to have regarding these results. And the first is around our risk reduction actions around interest rate sensitivity. You might ask, well, why now? And to answer that, I'll reinforce Donald's prepared remarks that with the basis changes and the interest rate decline in the third quarter, our interest rate sensitivity would have increased beyond levels that we would find tolerable. In addition, our view of the outlook is that there is now a higher probability of lower interest rates for an extended period of time. And as a result, we took actions to reduce our sensitivity in the third quarter and through a variety of measures plan to decrease our sensitivity meaningfully over the next several years. So to the extent rates continue to decline, we would also expect to generate additional gains on the sale of additional surplus bonds as a partial hedge. Another set of questions you might have is around goodwill. Now, why was this a third quarter event? What else is expected relative to IFRS? Well, first, let me remind you this is a non-cash, non-capital accounting charge, and we believe that the impact should be trivial. The triggering event was our recent decision to lower our sales plan materially for 2011 for long-term care and for the Universal Life No Lapse Guarantee business, reflecting our desire to shift our product mix in the low interest rate environment in order to reduce our risk sensitivity to interest rates on a CGAP basis. Current interest rates were also an important factor since they've reduced the future profitability of our in-force block and our new business. So while it was a judgment call, we viewed these circumstances as necessitating an acceleration of the goodwill review. We do not currently expect any additional CGAP income impact in the fourth quarter, nor do we expect a 2011 income impact at this time. We do estimate that we will have an additional $2.2 billion reduction in the goodwill on the balance sheet on January 1, 2011, when we transition to IFRS Phase 1. Now, another question you may have is regards to the U.S. life insurance business. You know, do we still like that business? The answer is an emphatic yes. We value the life insurance business very much. And in fact, our John Hancock life insurance business is a core franchise for our company. We feel good that we're positioned to grow our life insurance business over time, excluding the Universal Life No Lapse Guarantee product, which has the largest amount of interest rate sensitivity in the current interest rate environment. We believe that a shift to life insurance products without the lifetime no lapse guarantee feature is the direction that the overall market will likely take. So we continue to value the John Hancock life insurance business very much, and we expect to be successful. We simply want to contain the growth of the most interest rate sensitive products while growing the less sensitive product lines. And the fourth question that I'd like to address here is, what's our confidence level in achieving significant long-term care in-force price increases? Well, first, we recognize that there's uncertainty around our proposed in-force rate increases. We do believe, though, we have strong actuarial support for our proposed rates, including an independent review from an outside consultant. We also intend to offer equivalent benefit plan reductions to policyholders as an alternative to mitigate large rate increases, and we believe this will support our rate filings and reduce the potential policyholder reaction. Finally, we also see other major long-term care providers filing for large rate increases, and we believe it is widely recognized that this product is only viable if in-force rates reflect emerging experience for this business. So by way of summary, our underlying earnings were strong for the quarter, but were offset by reserve strengthening as a result of our annual basis change in the goodwill impairment. Excluding notable items, our adjusted earnings from operations were at the upper end of our previously stated range. MMI's capital position remains strong at 234% as of September 30th, up 13 points from the last quarter. We were able to increase our MCCSR in spite of the significant annual basis change. And we took important actions to materially reduce interest rate sensitivities. We also made substantial progress delivering upon our business strategy, achieving growth in our targeted products and reducing sales in areas that we've not targeted for growth. Our credit experience remains strong relative to market conditions, and overall, our businesses are well positioned for future growth as we continue to execute on our strategic plan. This now concludes our review of the results. And operator, we can now open the call to Q&A.
Thank you. We will now take questions from the telephone line. If you have a question and you're using a speakerphone, please lift your handset before making your selection. If you have a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. If at any time you wish to cancel your question, please press the pound sign. first question is from Tom McKinnon from BMO Capital Markets. Please go ahead.
Yeah, thank you very much. Just a couple questions. First of all, you talk about throughout the press release experience gains that were related to other non-fixed income returns being better than best estimate liability assumptions. I think we saw them in the Canadian, the U.S. divisions, the reinsurance division, the Asian division. And I know that you're working to hedge the your equity market exposure, your interest rate exposure, but there's a sizable sensitivity to changes in this other non-fixed income returns to the extent that they back best estimate liabilities, some $3 billion if we get 100 basis point decline. Is there ways to, first of all, can you share with us what sort of, you do share with us what the long-term assumption you use for your equity products, or for equities, 2% a quarter. Now, can you share with us what you have embedded in your best estimate assumptions and your actuarial liabilities for these non-fixed income returns? And if not, can you speak to how you might want to try to mitigate the, I guess, any sensitivity of this thing, which has increased quarter over quarter going forward? And I got one follow-up.
Okay, Tom, it's Mike. I'll start, and then I'll ask Warren and Scott to provide the investment perspective. First, just by way of overview, Tom, as you know, we're really proud of the non-fixed income investments that we have. This is a real core competency for the company. It has been for a long period of time. We think from a risk-reward standpoint, it's great. We love the diversified portfolio, so we think all of that's extremely important. Now, relative to your question on valuation. As you know, we do follow the Canadian Institute of Actuaries guidelines, and as we laid out in the MD&A, our NFI expected returns going forward are approximately in line with our public equity assumptions for that same basis. Now, looking backwards for a second, if we look back at the last, you know, say 5 years or so, NFI has actually been modestly positive relative to those long-term assumptions. I mean, it's been, you know, bouncy quarter to quarter, but it's overall been positive over the last 5 years. And again, this is a reminder that this is a very good diversification tool from a risk-reward standpoint, because, you know, even when public equities were bad, this was very very useful. So again, you know, we're sensitive to the same point that you made. We're sensitive to future returns on this this block of business. It's something that obviously we'll have to evaluate every year, both for the public equities as well as for NFI. But at this point, we're real comfortable. Warren and Scott, you want to add?
Sure, Michael. Thank you. Yeah, I think the biggest point is that this is a very diversified portfolio. You can see the holdings in our SIP. You know, there's a combination of real estate, agriculture, timber, private equity, and infrastructure investments. And, you know, for example, the last couple of years when the public markets have been challenged, some of those categories have outperformed their long-run returns. Agriculture would be a good example of that. And over the past 5 years, we've seen, you know, the average returns exceed our long-term expectations, although certainly, as Michael pointed out, there can be volatility quarter to quarter. I guess finally I'd mention that, you know, as we look in this category, we do look for the less volatile, lower return type categories. Our real estate book, for example, is largely Class A properties in downtown markets, and it's fully unlevered. So that dampens the volatility quite a bit. We like infrastructure investments that tend to be stable. So I think for all those reasons, you know, we're fairly confident we can achieve the returns that are built into our reserves, and that while, yes, they'll create some volatility going forward, they really are an excellent fit for our long-tailed liabilities, and, you know, we're quite proud of the portfolio.
Okay, thanks for that. And just as a follow-up, slide 16, when you talk about a 100 basis point drop in all rates hurting income by $2.2 billion, and you talk about the predominant influence is the long U.S. rates. First of all, do you mean long treasuries here? And when you talk about long U.S. rates, and secondly, what would happen if the drop wasn't parallel? What would happen if you got a steeper curve or a flattening curve or any of those How does that change that $2.2 billion?
Sure, Tom, it's Mike. I'll start, and others can add here. First, again, we were attempting to respond to yours and other analysts' questions around, you know, can you give us some rules of thumb? And I would emphasize this, our valuation model and the interaction between our valuation model and the investment portfolio is way too complicated to be boiled down to three numbers, for God's sake. But the what we're trying to communicate here is if you looked at the 30-year U.S. rates, those are, if you can only pick one point, that would be the
U.S. government rates.
Well, so 30-year, we'll start with the 30-year government rates, and then we'll talk about spreads. So if you just looked at the 30-year government rates in the U.S., that would be a good starting point. And if for argument's sake, if the 30-year U.S. government decline, say by God forbid 100 basis points again, and U.S. and spreads stayed the same. So that meant that, you know, corporate A spreads, for example, were down 100 basis points. And no other changes, which is a big caveat. We would expect a $2.2 billion hit. Now, again, it's not that pure. Canada has some impact. Asia has some impact. You know, the 10-year bond has some impact. But that really, after our actions that we took in third quarter, that's the most powerful factor. Now, the point that we're also making here is that if all rates dropped 100 points, but we saw, you know, a 50-point rise in spreads, that in fact would be that would mitigate some of that 2.2, and hence the importance of the 0.6 for the. And again, I would tend to look at the 30-year bond spreads, although again, 10-year bond spreads are also important. And then lastly, we're now longer from a swap perspective. So a drop in swap spreads helps us. A widening in swap spreads hurts us because we've got a fair amount of those assets now on the books. Again, let me see if the investment guys or Brev would want to add anything to that.
Okay. And the swap spreads you're defining as?
Spreads over governments on swaps, interbank swaps. And, yeah.
Swap less the government rate.
Right.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay,
yeah,
on the for 30 years. Is that
of the same duration.
Okay. All right, thanks very much.
I guess the other point that should come out is, I think Mike mentioned it, but the shape of the yield curve is very relevant, the way that we position the portfolio, and as a lot of people know, there's some steepening going on, so we'll be taking advantage of that. We are taking advantage of that.
Thank you. The next question is from André-Philippe Hardy from RBC Capital Markets. Please go ahead.
Just a clarification to Tom's questions. When you talk about the returns on the non-fixed income assets, you know, I would think of them as, in terms of future expected returns, thinking of the risk-free rate plus an appropriate risk premium, which would suggest that there's a real risk of these assets seeing a lower expected return going forward, given what's happened in recent years. Is that a fair assumption?
Well, Andre, I mean, I'm not going to tell you that it's without risk. You know, the good news is if we look at the past 5 years, which has not exactly been a positive environment, this asset class in aggregate for us has exceeded the long-term assumption. I'm cognizant and would not hesitate, though, to point out that, you know, the future has all sorts of uncertainties. But we like the diversification and we like the risk-reward trade-off.
I think it's important to note that this is a portfolio, in many cases, that we've been in 20, 30, 40, 50 years, some of these asset classes. The assets that we've selected are what I would characterize as core. We manage them well. Most of the management is executed by local teams that help ensure we have a good understanding of what's going on in the marketplace. And again, and think most of our assets have external marks put on by independent third parties. Our real estate appraisals are done by third-party appraisal firms. In this most recent quarter, we had appraisal gains on both our Canadian and U.S. Properties coming in from our third-party appraisers on the basis that we had very strong leasing and occupancy rates. So, Yeah, but, you know, you can describe, you know, I guess in first-year economics, everything is described as a risk-free rate plus something, right, depending on the asset class, which is not a bad way of looking at it to start with. The more important thing is the correlations between them, and as Warren and Mike have pointed out, these things aren't correlated. I mean, some of those asset classes during the worst part of the financial crisis were going up in value. Others were going down in value, but by nowhere near the same rate that, you know, high-yield bonds or equities were going down. And it's that diversification and lack of correlation. Anything less than perfect correlation is a friend.
Thank you. And the question that I had was around long-term care and, you know, price increase requests of 40% for 80% of the in-force. I'm a little surprised that you're seeking price increases on 80% of the in-force, and maybe it was a misunderstanding on my part, but I thought that the blocks that you had issues with were their legacy blocks, and perhaps they were 80% of the in-force, and that's what's happening. Is that the case? Or?
Andre, I'll start and see if Jim Boyle wants to add. It is the case that the 40% is not uniform across the book of business. It is the case that the older blocks have tended to have the worst experience. Older blocks, therefore, on average, are getting larger increases. Also remember, Andre, that over the last several years, we've been steadily increasing new business prices. And so, you know, we're in an environment right now where our new business prices are materially above the average in-force rates. And as a result, the business that we've written more recently, in many cases, needs either zero or small rate increases. The other point I would make is that, just reiterating my prepared remarks, we are offering policyholders the option to elect benefit plan reductions as a way of mitigating those rate increases. So again, we think that's another tool that will be useful in terms of executing on this. Jim, you want to add?
No, Mike, I think you summarized it correctly, Mike. 40% is clearly an average. The experience that we saw through our actuarial studies after 2004, when we put in some more scientific underwriting, as the rest of the industry did with cognitive screening and others, the results are much better, and therefore the increases would be much lower than that average. But, you know, to your basic question, you know, the 80% is largely the business that was written pre-2004.
Okay. Thank you. That clarifies things.
Thank you. The next question is from Michael Goldberg from Desjardins Securities. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Have you redeployed the proceeds from the sales of bonds and equities backing surplus that you you discussed? Is there any change in your investment mix on assets backing surplus? And also, is there any change that you foresee in the investment mix and assets backing liabilities, given your concern about the interest rates staying lower for longer than you thought previously?
Yeah, Michael, it's Mike. I'll start and again ask the others to add. The first on your question on the surplus assets. The most important thing here is that we harvested the gains that we had on the surplus bonds, on a large chunk of the surplus bonds, and then we turned around and reinvested those proceeds into even longer bonds with a longer duration, in many cases 30-year treasuries. And there are a couple of interesting points there. One is that we collected the gains, but we have really only a very modest impact, less than $10 million a quarter on a go-forward basis in terms of lower IOS, because as Donald mentioned earlier, the yield curve is so steep right now that being able to go out longer on the curve enables us to preserve the yield, even though we sold the bonds that were above the original book value. So the answer there is we lengthened the surplus bonds with those proceeds. In terms of the liabilities, a couple of pieces there. On the liabilities, we also lengthened the duration pretty significantly, both in the cash markets as well as through derivatives. We did, as noted in the slides, we did take on $4.5 to $5 billion of additional forward-starting swaps that also lengthened the duration of the liabilities. Scott or Warren, want to add?
Sure. I saw that, Michael, and what I'd suggest is that in surplus, we're clearly moving to a higher quality, more liquid mix, but longer. And as Michael said, those sort of offset each other. With a steep yield curve, you get a lot more yield for going out long, but we're losing a little yield because we're moving to a higher quality, more liquid. In the liabilities, I would say not so much the case. I think the mix is intended to stay the same in the shortest term. We did move into treasuries in order to get the duration we were looking for, and the intent and hope would be to roll that into more corporates going forward, which would create the opportunity for trading gains going forward.
And where you would see that is if you look at our asset mix as at the end of Q3, about 20% of our assets are now in government bonds on an in-total basis. And the government bonds are in liability segments. They are a temporary hold until we find appropriate corporates, and that's when we trade out of those governments into corporates. That's what gives rise to the trading gains in our source of earnings analysis.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from Darko Mihaly from Cormark Securities. Please go ahead.
Hi. Actually, a couple of questions. The first is, if we can look at the source of earnings and the expected profit on in-force, can you just walk me through the big quarter-over-quarter jump, and how am I supposed to think of that? You know, all else equal, is that a good run rate for expected profit in force going forward?
Darko, it's Mike. I'll start. In terms of the source of earnings, a couple things there are important. First of all, the obviously, it bounces around quarter to quarter, but I think if you look over the long-term pattern, the most important thing is that our strategy is working. We've been growing the businesses that that we want to grow that give rise to greater earnings at lower risk, and again, that particularly shows up if you look at the currency-adjusted expected profit on in-force. Now, in terms of your question on is it a good run rate going forward? Again, it will bounce around quarter to quarter. So I would not get carried away as on any given quarter's results. But if you were to ask, is that a reasonable expectation for the next, you know, four quarters on average? I'm not aware of anything today in either the Q3 results or in the outlook that would make that an unreasonable expectation.
Okay, and maybe just another question unrelated. I noticed S&P put your ratings in watch for with negative implications. Does that matter? Should we care? A question maybe for Donald, but should we care about that? And what is Manulife's response to that?
Well, yeah, we care, but I think S&P, responded to the earnings number for the quarter and also the goodwill charge. I mean, the way we look at it, we have strengthened our reserve enormously and think we've, improved our claims paying abilities, the actions that we've taken in the quarter, by taking the stronger reserve, but also substantial repositioning of the business. I mean, the goodwill is a direct reflection of what's going on in the economy and the substantial repositioning that we've taken in the business to reduce the risk profile on a current basis and going forward. You know, when Mike talked about the improvement in the adjusted earnings from operations, that's coming from price increases on products and the elimination of strain that happens as a result of that, and it shows up pretty quickly under the Canadian GAAP basis. It's quite appropriate. So that repositioning, is painful in terms of writing off goodwill, but it's a positive repositioning for the business going forward. And, I spent a lot of my life rating credits, and I would give a credit improvement for that, not a credit downgrade. But S&P has their own methodology. We respect them a great deal, and they haven't made up their mind, and, as indicated by what they've done. So, we'll be talking to them.
you know, we've adopted revised targets for hedging both interest rates and equities. You know, we get the sense that investors are fatigued with interest rate and equity sensitivity. And while we still want to be, you know, very much market dependent, Mike said, you know, we're not going to be market dependent. We are going to be market dependent, but we're not solely going to be market dependent. We've adopted minimums, time-based minimums that we will follow so that our investors and rating agencies and others who look at us have comfort that we will get to the targets within 4 years, that they aren't just a pipe dream. You know, the goal is to have hedges so that 60% of our earnings sensitivity will be from equities will be decreased by 2002 and going to 12, and 75% by the end of 2014. Very, very substantial. You know, the underlying strength and quality of the U.S. franchise remains high. I mean, you know, the goodwill right now, again, it's a function of interest rates and it's a function of the repositioning of the business, but we're very committed to the business. Again, the adjusted earnings from operations was up 72%, and it wasn't just up 72% from the prior quarter. It's the same approximately order of magnitude against the first quarter and the quarter before that, and there's no reason why that run rate would be expected to go down, as Michael said. So that's a very, very substantial improvement in that business. And, you know, when they talk about the, you know, the mutual fund sales, actually hurt earnings in the first year because of the way the acquisition costs are treated, not capitalized. So that's actually been a hurt to earnings. But I defy anybody to sell $8 billion in mutual funds and feel bad about it because, you know, it's the gift that keeps on giving, as long as you keep the money and performance is good, which our performance is good. So the goodwill impairment has not impacted our regulatory capital, at least, does not impact our earnings capability. And, in fact, the very things that gave rise to the goodwill impairment are things that are reducing our risk going forward and improving earnings going forward. And you would think when you're doing a credit judgment that that would figure pretty significantly in your mind. So I guess the last thing I'd say is you know, just having a skim of the Standard & Poor's release, I would draw your attention to the many positives outlined in the S&P press release regarding our strong competitive position, capitalization, all the nice things they say about our investment risk. You know, they're essentially acknowledging that the strategy of a blend of NFI and other assets keeps us out of the riskiest end of the fixed income spectrum, which is frankly where all the real debacle occurred in the meltdown. And you know, we came through that as well as anybody. We're very proud of it. It's nice to see S&P recognize it. But you know, our goal, we should have amongst the highest ratings. You know, unfortunately, some of the decisions we've taken have not led to that result, and we will get them back on track.
But does a rating decrease hurt your business?
Well, you know, if S&P were to decrease our ratings, it certainly doesn't reflect the quality of Manulife that we think, and, you know, that annoys our distributors. But we would be in line with other companies, other pretty good companies. It's just that we believe we deserve to be a notch above. And, you know, we're a proud company, and, yes, it would hurt some portion of the business, but, you know, I don't think it'd be that significant. But the fact of the matter is the ratings should reflect the quality of the company, and the quality of Manulife should be reflected by higher ratings than we have at present, let alone lower than we have at present.
So, in other words, you wouldn't do anything to protect that rating balance sheet-wise?
We manage, you know, we don't manage our company for the quarter-to-quarter earnings. We don't manage it for the quarter-to-quarter stock price, and we don't manage it for the quarter-to-quarter ratings. We manage it for the long term. We're taking these decisions for the long term. They're clearly in the long term health of the business, and that's the way we're going to run it. And lots of people are entitled to their opinion, but we're going to run it for the long term in keeping with our strategic plan. We're doing the right stuff. And again, you know, the actions that we're taking that give rise to that goodwill write-off, that is alarming to people. You know, it's $1 billion. I don't like that number. But the actions that we're taking that give rise to that are actions to reduce risk, produce more stable earnings and a higher ROE for the long term of this business. And it's not a pipe dream, as indicated by everything we've talked about. The results are coming in this quarter.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. The next question is from Steve Theriault from Bank of America Merrill Lynch. Please go ahead.
Thanks very much. I just want to talk a bit about the hedging initiatives. Don, you pushed back pretty consistently from the idea of crystallizing some of the non-cash charges that have come through over the last couple of years. Now, we've talked about the why, and I appreciate a lot of the explanation, but a couple of questions. In terms of the book value, how much potential notional book value upside do you think you're giving up as a result of the hedging initiatives? And can you talk a bit about the costs of employing the equity market and rate strategies that you've described to us today, or is it more of a question really of opportunity cost?
It's mostly a question of opportunity cost. I think Bev is talking, she's here and prepared to talk about, you know, some of the average costs of hedging and so on, you know, which we have not had any terrible surprises there. It's been consistent with what we viewed, you know, so far. We're going to be taking some different approaches, putting on macro hedges, you know, not necessarily with the interest rate leg associated with it, which is a little different approach. Again, not expected to cost more on a percentage basis over time. You know, I think you are right. The way to look at it is in terms of opportunity cost if markets go up. And if you look at our equity or interest rate sensitivities, you can see, you know, the upside and the downside there. Our goal is to eliminate as little as the upside as possible, and I think we've acted consistent with that. You know, we hedged $15 billion in the first quarter when equity markets were high. We didn't hedge anything in the second quarter. In the third quarter, we did a little bit, you know, $3.3 billion. And, you know, this quarter we're at it again. Given the markets are up about 20% from the lows of the summer, I think you should anticipate an acceleration of our hedging activity because, as I've said to investors, we're not going to hedge it at the bottom. We're trying to get it out now that, you know, equity markets are up. That's in the interest of shareholders. But we're also saying, and again, I'll be honest, some of our shareholders are getting fatigued and saying, gosh, if markets stay flat or go lower, you won't proceed on any hedging. So we're introducing time-based triggers that basically forces us to, you know, meet targets. But, you know, the essence of it will still have a very opportunistic overlay. So you can expect, if markets stay where they are, you know, more hedging in this quarter.
So on the rate side, you don't view some of the interest rate hedging actions as necessarily locking in reserves?
Well, there's two things. What happens is, you know, when the actuaries put pads on the low rates and project the low rates forever, they create an impact on the financial statement that, you know, is, frankly, I think exaggerated relative to the economic impact. But given that it impacts capital and earnings, you know, it gets to a level where you can't tolerate it anymore. And that's frankly what happened in the second quarter. We said as we looked to the third quarter, you know, some of the basis changes lengthen our liabilities. You know, with rates going down, you've got the conjoint impact of lengthening liabilities and lower rates. So that creates a rather dramatic effect. We said we can't let this thing go unconstrained. I mean, you know, most of the people in the room would believe over the fullness of time interest rates will go back to normal levels, but it looks like it's going to be a longer period of time than anyone thought. I mean, you know, the quantitative easing that's taken place and continues for a while. And, you know, so rates are going to be lower for a while, plus you have to have a stop loss eventually on everything. So we're not embarrassed to be, you know, limiting the total exposure that we have and gradually over time getting it back in line. I guess the thing that a lot of people overlook because they focused on earnings sensitivity is the economic sensitivity. And, you know, in Manulife, we always had a posture in the surplus segment to go fairly long in our fixed income investments. It's interesting that just about everything we have here is marked to market for capital and earnings and other things. But what's not marked to market for capital purposes and earnings purposes is our surplus bonds. So as rates were going down and we're taking it on the chin in terms of the reserves, huge gains were being built up in the surplus portfolio. We decided to trigger those gains to get regulatory capital credit, which is legitimate, right thing to do. The aberration was the fact that we didn't get any credit for that before. So we triggered the gains, and you know what we've done is reloaded with the bonds so that if interest rates actually go down further, we will generate more gains. And you know, if those of you who observed our interest rate sensitivity and looked at it on an economic basis versus a earnings basis, you would have observed that the economic basis, the risk was lower, and that's why, because the surplus was a natural offset, not a perfect offset, I'd like to say it was, but it was an offset to the direction of the on the liability portfolios.
Okay, thanks for that. If I'm one more question, if I might, just on the a numbers question on the equity sensitivity, the target of having 60% of the underlying sensitivity hedged. So I'm trying to do a little work reverse engineering the math here. Would that imply that all else being equal, the $1.3 billion of sensitivity to a 10% equity market decline drops to somewhere in the range of $700 million, assuming no new business? Or if not, is there a way that I can think of that in terms of in dollar terms?
Bet signaling that you got it right on.
Okay.
To the accuracy displayed by her fingers. She had seven fingers up when you said that, so congratulations.
Thanks, Don. I'll leave it there.
Okay.
Thank you. The next question is from Doug Young from TD Newcrest. Please go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. Just, I guess, a few questions. And first one, I don't know if it's for Jim or for Michael, just around the long-term care business and the reserve charge you took. Obviously, and you've explained it in the release, that it's very dependent upon what your assumption is of what you get of the 40% on average price increase and the timing of that. And I'm wondering if you can give us a sense of what you've assumed in your model. Is it 75% of that 40% increase, and over what time frame? And I think you've assumed it's all implemented next year. And the second part of the question is if you get 10%, let's say, less than what you're assuming, or if you have to wait another year before full implementation, can you give us a sense of what that means in terms of additional charges that you may have to take? And I have a follow-up as well.
Okay, Doug, it's Mike. The just first, by way of background, there continues to be obviously uncertainty around this area. So again, we're cognizant of the risk that you're pointing to here. We did go through a detailed analysis to come up with our best estimate of the timing of the regulatory approvals, as well as exactly what will get approved. As you well know, under CGAP, we actually have to add a provision for adverse deviation on top of that. And we did all of that with the benefit of the experience we've seen from others, and also help that we got from our outside actuarial consultant who had a fair amount of data. Again, all in, the reserves are counting on $3 billion of additional in-force rate increases, that $3 billion being a pre-tax number. But I would really prefer at this point not to disclose the specific timing and percentage assumptions other than that. Again, we'll certainly keep you updated as experience emerges. I mean, again, fair to say it's going to take some time, but I'd rather not go through that detail at this point.
I guess, the reason I ask is that we've gone through your filing in Pennsylvania alone and looked at the data, and it looks like you're asking for upwards of 90% increases in certain instances, which seems unlikely immediately, but maybe not. You're not assuming that you're going to get immediately 90% and phased in. So we're trying to get a sense of that. So, any additional color on that would be helpful.
Yeah, again, fair to say, Doug, that we're not assuming that we're going to get it day one. So, we're not assuming that the minute the filing hits the department, it's all set. But again, I just really prefer not to dig into the additional details at this point. Fair to say, we will continue to give you updates on future quarters as experience emerges.
I'd like Jim to get in, but that's clearly an outlier, Doug. There are numbers that are that high, but anyway, I'm going to pass it over to Jim, but that's not at all, representative.
Yeah, Doug, I understand your desire for a number and an ability to model the sensitivity, but, frankly, there's a lot going on here. We just saw, a significant election in the United States where more than 50% of the governors turned over, and it's likely we'll have new insurance commissioners in many of those jurisdictions. We are very comfortable with the actuarial analysis. There's a process, a very scripted process that you go through with the states. We've been through this before. I think you'll recall in 2007 we had an in-force rate increase. It was less significant. It was closer to 15%. We had to make a lot of the same judgments around timing, effectiveness, et cetera. We've executed on or better than that plan in 2007. And one of the key components that, was mentioned in the prepared remarks was the fact that although we're filing for these rate increases, and, you're right, in some cases it could be as high as 90%. That would be an outlier. In each case, we will offer the clients an ability to reduce their benefit. And in most cases, you know, products that had a 5% annual inflation feature, for example, you know, we can offer a client the ability, depending on the product series and type, you know, to go to 4% or 3% and have virtually no rate increase whatsoever. And our experience has been, you know, that more than 50% of the clients will opt for, you know, a benefit reduction, particularly understanding this low interest rate environment we're in. So this is going to take, you know, more than a year. You know, that's built into our modeling here. There's a lot to play out here because there'll be a lot of new players, but the facts support this rate increase, and, you know, we're not an outlier here. There's others in the industry that are dealing with the same math, and so, you know, I think it would just be more prudent for us to continue to give you updates on a quarterly basis as we learn more, but as of today, we're quite comfortable in our assumptions, our methodology, and our approach here.
Okay, and then just second is on the slide 16 talking about now spread widening or the impact from spread widening and so forth. And I know at the end of Q2, you know, there was a discussion that spreads would no longer have an impact. And I think, you know, as a result of a lot of changes that happened in Q3, spreads do have an impact. But I guess I'm a little confused about that. And so if you can give some sense of why now we're looking at spreads again, because I just thought spreads were going to be graded down to the long-term average after 20 years.
Sure, Doug, it's Mike. I'll start and ask Cindy if she wants to add. First, when we talked about spreads not having an impact at Q2, the reason for that is that we had capped spreads in recognition that we were going to be moving to this graded approach. So we didn't want to be in a position when spreads widened in Q2 to take a bunch of benefit from that, only to then turn around and reverse it at Q3. We've now moved to the methodology that says for corporate spreads, we're going to grade over a 5-year period from the current spreads to the long-term averages. So by the time we're starting to model cash flows that are going to be coming in, you know, 6 years from now, 7 years from now, we're going to be looking at long-term average spreads rather than current spreads. The 20-year grading that I think you're referencing is the grading to the ultimate reinvestment rate. So we do assume that throughout the 20-year period, we're investing a greater proportion of cash flow that gets invested in bonds, a greater proportion in government bonds over that period. And by the time we get to 20 years, we're assuming that all of our positive cash flows that are being invested in fixed income investments are in fact being invested in government bonds at the ultimate reinvestment rate. That URR, that ultimate reinvestment rate, is subject to additional because it's a mechanical weighted average formula, and if rates, you know, continue to stay down, that rolling average formula will continue to drift down. So they're really two different issues, but with the methodology that we've implemented, the grading to 5-year spreads says that if spreads bump up tomorrow, we get a benefit from that because we're you know, it'll grade off over 5 years, but we'll get a real benefit from that for cash flows invested in the next 5 years. Cindy, you want to add?
I answered the question well.
Okay. Now that helps a lot. Just last number question. What is your URR assumption now?
Let's see. I believe, Cindy can correct me here, I believe the long bond rate is now 4% in the U.S. and 3.8% in Canada?
You're correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from Robert Sedran from CIBC. Please go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. Just a couple of quick follow-ups. I know you don't want to, and for good reason, I guess, tell us what the probability that you've assigned on some of these long-term care price increases is, but do you have to disclose it to the regulator when you make the application?
No, Robert, we do not.
Okay. Just following up on the adjusted earnings from operations, Mike, you know, there's a lot of items on that slide 8. I know a shorthand that has worked in the past, it's not working so well today, is to basically zero out assumption changes and experience gains.
Yes.
And then just apply a normal tax rate. Now, that approach would actually get me considerably below the 779. So is there something in those two lines that is sort of a recurring or part of normalized earnings? How should I think about that?
Well, let's see. Robert, there are a number of different issues. You know, currency can play some havoc with that. You know, we've now got the there are a lot of moving parts around interest rates and equity markets. You know, we've got, for example, the investment gains for the realized capital gains for the surplus bonds. We've got investment gains from the change in the mix for the assets backing the liabilities. Again, there are just a number of different issues that are impacting those numbers. The adjusted earnings from operation is calculated consistently with the definition that we defined back at the beginning of July here in 2009. So we've kept that definition as consistent as possible, but I think there are other moving parts that are playing havoc with that.
So some of those items that are on slide 8 may well be in expected profit or earnings on surplus or somewhere else as well, in other words.
Yeah, it's probably worth having some discussion offline to talk about some of the geography issues. But,
okay, and just very very quickly, lastly, I gather the full $2 billion in new hold co debt that was downstream was downstream during the quarter. Can you tell us how much of the $5 billion in long-term debt on the balance sheet might be sitting in MLI as equity? Should I assume most of it is?
Yeah, Robert, the vast, vast bulk of it.
Okay.
It's literally not every penny, but the vast bulk of it.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from Mario Mendonca from Canaccord Genuity. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon. In previous calls, when the idea that the company might be a little more aggressive in hedging equity markets or interest rate exposure, when that was proposed, there was a sense of almost fatality to it, that it would result in very significant charges, it would affect your expected profit going forward, might have to raise capital. Those are some of the things that were brought up. This quarter, this has a sort of a feeling of something for nothing to it, that there's a lot of hedging that you're proposing that you've done and will do, but yet when you talk about your expected profit going forward or your normalized earnings or core earnings going forward, it doesn't sound like there's much of an effect that you're suggesting. Am I misreading it? Is there much of an effect going forward?
Well, yeah, there is an effect, Mario. The big difference, and you know, you're one of the smartest guys out there, so I apologize if it sounds too basic, but is where equity markets are. And we've seen a huge move in equity markets, since July. And, we're going to take advantage of that. The other thing that is associated with it is, and we're going to be managing the interest sensitivity on both scores, but it's a second order. This is a little bit more tricky, and that is there's many different approaches to hedging. The one that we have been using up to now has been dynamic hedging, which is a fancy word for shorting the futures, and since that gives rise to a certain amount of interest rate sensitivity in the settlements, you basically put on a swap to take away some of that interest rate sensitivity. When interest rates are low, swap rates are low particularly, that makes that more expensive to do. And so what we're looking on is macro hedges, which is, like a macro call, like a CIO saying, I just want to lessen my exposure overall to equity markets, not related to any individual policy or any group of policies, any cohort of policies. It can be equity risk giving rise from fees on mutual funds, fees on variable annuities, or even balance sheet holdings of equities. But I want to reduce my equity risk. You put that on, basically by shorting futures, there's less of an interest component embedded in it. And, in a situation like now where equity markets have gone up but swap rates are low, I'm not sure it makes a lot of sense to put on the swap leg. So maybe we just short the future, which is, called in the parlance of macro hedge, and that's probably more of what we're likely to be doing in the short term, although the stuff that we did today was the more conventional dynamic hedging, because at the level that the cohort of products was at, we could put on the swap and even with low swap rates be effective.
So Mario, it's Mike. Just to add a couple of additional factoids. First, as we've talked about before, a reasonable rule of thumb for the dynamic hedging that we've been doing in the last year and a half is that for every $1 billion of guaranteed value that we've been hedging when it's pretty close to at the money under the dynamic hedging approach, that costs us approximately 50 basis points after tax in earnings going forward. So, you know, as an example, the $26 billion of in-force now that we've hedged since June 30th of 2009 would cost us $130 million of after-tax earnings going forward. That's the rule of thumb we've given you in the past, and that continues to be a reasonable one. I think the point that Donald is making, and I'll invite Bev to add here if she'd like, is that as we look at different approaches to accelerate that hedging, including possibly going to a macro hedge kind of approach, we may have to update that 50 basis points. We're evaluating a number of different options, and we'll be back to you.
But every indication is it's roughly. I mean, you know, if it's 52 or 48, we're not going to quibble. But and it actually depends on the circumstance. It's roughly in line with the same cost. The other thing I want to say that people sometimes miss is we're ahead of our hedging targets, right? You know, at the end of the first quarter, we're 18 months ahead of the glide path that we had established for ourselves. We've never been behind to that. What, you know, you go a quarter when the markets were down, like the second quarter, everybody panics that's going to continue forever. You know, I'll make a very simple point, but a subtlety that seems to get lost is that if you told me with perfect certainty that the equity market was going to be the same in 4 years from now, the level of the S&P, the same as it was today, I'd take you a huge bet that at some point along that path is higher and another point is going to be lower. Because of the inherent volatility. And we're going to take advantage of those swings and go aggressively in when, you know, markets are a little higher as they are now and pull back as we did in the second quarter when markets are lower. And that's 100% shareholders' interest. You know, sometimes the rating agencies get annoyed at that approach, but it's a good approach. On the other hand, you know, some of our investors are saying, I want some certainty that you'll get to the end point. And so what we're also sort of committing to is a time-based minimum to be measured on a progress basis, on a to-date basis, not to say that every quarter we'll have to do some hedging, but we're going to measure ourselves against a time base to make sure that we're always ahead of that the vector described by that. So our investors can have comfort that by the end of the 4 years, we will meet those targets come hell or high water, but we're going to be opportunistic about the rate at which we progress in any given quarter. If that makes any sense.
Yeah. So if I could take this just one step further, then if you were to reduce your equity market sensitivity to 60% by the end of 2012, what would that imply? What would the effect be on your expected profit from where it stands today?
Beth, why don't you answer that?
Probably about perhaps $100 million.
Additional to what you would have done today.
Although, again, very importantly, Mario, that will depend upon exactly what tools we use, where markets are at the time. So, again, we'll give you further updates on that. I need to say one other thing, and that does mean I need to correct the answer that I gave Darko. That is obviously something that would impact the run rate on expected profit from in-force. That I wasn't thinking about when when I answered his question. I assumed his question was not including the impact of the hedging. So just a clarification there for Mario, for you and Darko.
Now that $100 million, you're referring to that on an annual basis, pre-tax on your expected profit from going to 60%.
Importantly, that would be after tax.
After tax.
And again, that would be the equivalent, if you will, of the drag we would expect from hedging $20 billion of guaranteed value at the money. And again, there are a lot of moving parts that would impact that, what that ultimately is.
And I'm sorry for...
And it's Bev, I would just like to add that $100 million there's a range. There's a range around it. We can't predict exactly what it will be. So, you know, it could be higher, could be lower, depending on when we actually hedge along the way. So,
yeah,
but it's in the range.
I think all we're trying to do, though, is get a sense for, like, there's a cost to everything. if there wasn't a cost to this, you would have done this ages ago. So
the biggest cost, Mario, and I think we were clear, you know, Bev estimated before, I can't remember exactly what the number was, but the full cost of getting to our target at the end, you know, people asked about it. But what she underlined importantly, that assumes, you know, that we're doing sort of at the money or whatever. It's the timing of when you execute. But the biggest cost is the opportunity cost of putting on the hedges too early. I mean, you know, if you do the math, there were a lot of people around in May and June of 2009 saying, hedge the stuff, get it behind you. We didn't do that. We took a lot of pain. We had to cut our dividend. We had to, you know, raise equity and so on. You know, we've made billions by deferring to this time. And, you know, we have a really good plan, and we're going to follow it.
Yeah, and all I'm trying to do is just try to understand the numbers. I wouldn't. I'm not opining on whether it was a good call, bad call, or anything. $100 million after tax over a full year to get to that 60% target, and then to get to the 75% target, I believe. Bev, would that be, say, another 100 on top of that?
It would probably be another. Probably another 150 after that. But it's a range. It's really a range, and, you know, it really depends. I mean, it could be, you know, another 100 to 200, because it really depends on what markets are at when we do that, and what swap rates are when we go there, and, you know, what has happened in between with the volume of our business. So It's quite a range.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And then maybe finally, question for you.
Well, the other thing, Mario, just because you're asking some good questions, the other thing that would happen is if we put it on, for instance, now using dynamic hedging with low swap rates, we would take a earnings charge in addition to what Bev described, which is the ongoing run rate. You'd have an upfront earnings charge and no credit for hedging, no offsetting credit in the capital for hedging at this time. So, you know, we wouldn't view that as necessarily the right thing to do.
Right. So I just want to follow along this something for nothing kind of idea, because I don't believe that that's what you're actually saying. I think
No,
not at all.
Contrary.
When you take trigger gains in your AFS book to reduce the effects of declining interest rates, is it fair to say that those are gains now that just they're gone, they're used, you can't use them again? So are you giving up some future earnings in your earnings on surplus as a result?
Well, Mario, it's Mike. It obviously depends upon how we reinvest those proceeds. As I mentioned on one of the earlier answers, we went longer with the reinvested proceeds, and therefore it was really a de minimis impact on overall interest on surplus expectations going forward. So, again, that's not always going to be the case. What we view as being the more permanent ongoing item is this is a natural hedge, a natural partial hedge to the interest rate sensitivity that we have on the liabilities. That's really the main point.
Mike, I understand the interest argument that you're using there. What I'm referring to is, as you said yourself, AFS is not marked to market. So once you have marked it by selling it, those unrealized gains are now realized, so they're gone forever. Is that true? Like,
yes. I think that's a fair comment, Mario.
But okay, and then fine.
They weren't, Mario, just so everybody understands. I think you got it, but there's other people on the call. That gain was never finding its way in the capital calculation. It was a bigger gain than many companies would have. There's a whole story there about why it wasn't marked to market historically. But that big gain, you know, is there. It's not. We're not getting any capital credit for it whatsoever. So it's a latent. You know, item. We're making it a real item, but then we're also reinvesting in long bonds in the surplus, so we're reloading. Because the yield curve is now so steep, the carry difference between riding the old bonds that were obviously had a higher coupon and the new bonds being reinvested, because the steepness of the yield curve, there's not as much give on the carry as one would assume. And, you know, when we get, you know, people talked about contingency plans on our last call. What are your contingency plans if interest rates go lower? Well, we had a multiple of things that we could do. And this was, you know, a highly palatable alternative.
I totally get it. Now, finally, Donald, the final question then. Now that the company's taking, it would appear, some of the downside risk off the table, and it's probably a good thing. Investors are sort of reacting to it, I think, positively. Does this change your perspective on what Manulife's long-term ROE capabilities are?
Well, we're hoping to improve Manulife's long-term ROE capabilities, and let me be clear here, not through the goodwill write-downs.
I know that.
We're not that kind of people that take credit for lowering the denominator. But, yes, you know, what we're trying to do, you'll be able to see this is very transparent what we're doing. Again, timing is very essential here, and we're taking the risk off at the most appropriate times. No, I don't think it diminishes the ROE potential. In fact, we're enhancing the ROE potential through the other changes that we're making to the business mix, as evidenced by the all of our comments on the growth in the adjusted earnings for operations. You know, what we've been dedicated to, and it's a pretty simple story, but we've executed it well, is a couple of things. Number one, we recognize that we wouldn't be able to control equity markets and interest rates and how they buffeted our income statement. So we want to focus on growing earnings, you know, adjusted for those factors. Grow the core earnings, if you will, as aggressive as we can. The second thing we want to do is make sure that we're shifting our capital allocation to products that have the highest ROE potential and the lowest relative risk potential. And we're doing that, and we're doing it incredibly successfully. And if we keep doing those things and opportunistically hedge away some of the other risks, we will end up with a more stable income stream than before, a higher ROE than before, and very nice earnings growth. And so far, we're executing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. The next question is from Colin Devine from Citigroup. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon. I have a couple questions. I guess first on, just to be very clear, with S&P's action, because certainly it seems to, at least to me, they replaced the capital pretty quickly that the company lost in the second quarter, that if it comes to a downgrade, you're not prepared to raise common equity to avoid that. I think everybody will feel better getting that clarified. Second, with respect to, if I look at the long-term care line, and I'm trying to understand exactly what has gone on there over the past year, and I'm looking at how much the assets backing that line are up. Is the bulk of what's been, I don't know, almost a 50% increase, how much of that is coming from reserve adds? And then finally, with respect to interest rates, you know, if I look at the hedging you're doing this quarter, finally, is it fair to conclude that Manulife has worked out that it's, in fact, perhaps more sensitive to interest rates than it is to equity markets?
Well, let's see. You had a series there. The first one's easy to deal with. S&P didn't ask us to raise equity. It didn't suggest it, at least to my knowledge, in any discussions I had with them, and they knew what the answer would be. We don't intend to do that. We don't think this is necessary. Again, let's be clear, you know, this whole interest rate thing is a mark-to-market, and these are very long liabilities. And if you believe that rates will eventually go back to more normal levels and quantitative easing will stop, which you have to believe if you believe in the future of the global economy, you know, it's not going to be a long-term problem. But under Canadian GAAP, we're mark-to-market, and people have reacted to that. And so we understand it, but it is a mark-to-market. The same is true, you know, these VA liabilities don't come due, I think, on average for something like 15 years. The earliest that comes due is the Japan block in 7 years. Again, very substantial reserves aside that. The odds are that, you know, markets will go up and that we'll make a profit on those businesses, but we got a very heavy mark-to-market on those businesses, and as indicated by our comparison between U.S. GAAP and Canadian GAAP, a much more heavy mark on Canadian GAAP than, you know, would be true on U.S. GAAP. So those things, I think, you know, rating agencies and others react to that, but, you know, that's not the thing that you go and raise equity for unless you really get up above the wall. And then, as we said in our last call and have indicated in this quarter and other quarters, we do have other things that we can pursue, you know, to restore our capital position if we found it necessary. The other thing is, again, the opportunistic hedging is going to reduce the sensitivity to those things. The relativity, Colin, it depends on what happens, right? As rates go lower, you know, due to convexity, the interest rate sensitivity goes up. And, you know, as equity markets go lower, you know, there's something comparable that occurs there. So it depends on what situation is. If rates went back up, you'd find our interest rate sensitivity diminishes quite a bit. And if equity markets go up for equity sensitivity, it all depends on what happens. But I think the most important thing to remember is both of them are mark to markets.
And, Don, I guess 2 points we need to clarify. One, variable annuities do not have a maturity. The benefit is triggered by the age of the policyholder as to when they can use it. So it's not a question of 5 years or 6 years or 7 years.
Yeah.
It's when they hit the age. And I think, frankly, you misspoke, because once if they do start systematic withdrawals, right, then you're looking at a life annuity at that point. The second thing, you know, while you took great credit earlier that you did not hedge the equity exposure when the markets were down, and that has made Manulife billions, I guess it seems to me that the decision not to hedge declining interest rates, such as some of your peers did, whether it's Sun Life or Met, by buying floors, why wouldn't I conclude that that has cost Manulife billions looking at the losses over the past year? Why is that an unfair conclusion?
Well, I think, you know, I think it's fair to say that interest rates fell more than, I guess, a lot of people expected. People who bought floors, I think, did really well with those floors. Again, it's a mark-to-market, Colin. I mean, but, you know, 20/20 hindsight, there's a lot of things you could have done. You know, that's a fair comment. But, you know, it is what it is. We're dealing with it, and, you know, we're very comfortable with a certain amount of interest rate risk, again, with a view, but, you know, people's view of how long this thing is going to last has changed. Our view certainly has, and, you know, at the end of the day, you can have all kinds of bets on that work, but, you know, if a bet goes against you, the obligation is to close off the bet at some time, not to take unlimited amount of risk, and that's what we're doing.
And your question was selling the bonds out of the corporate surplus, and I certainly appreciate why you did that. But why hasn't that been extended to your real estate properties? I would assume the same rationale would hold. And frankly, as I look at it, Manulife seems to be really the last major North American life company to have a significant owned real estate portfolio. It's hard. I just have a tough time believing that your liabilities are so different versus everybody else's.
Well, you know, everybody might not be as capable of managing real estate. Colin, if you look at the...
You're a life company, Don. You're not, with all due respect, you're not a real estate company. You're a life insurance company.
We manage real estate as well as anybody, but Colin, that's the minor point. The more major point is...
The $6 billion portfolio, that's not
that. Okay, Colin, just let me finish. The more major point is I defy you to name a company, any sizable company that's performed better on their general account assets than we have. And the reason for that is the highly diversified portfolio.
Actually, Met Life has. I'll tell you right now. So it's proof, frankly. So, but I guess we'll have to agree to disagree.
Well, Colin, I think you have to look at not net unrealized losses, but gross unrealized losses, right? The fact that interest rates have gone down don't necessarily skate you onside with respect to credit problems. And I'm not speaking of either one of those companies specifically, but I think you have to look at that. You know, if I've got a bond that's worth 60% of par, despite the fact that interest rates have come down, I've got another bond that's a government bond that's worth 120% of par, you know, just because interest rates have gone down, adding the two together to say I've got a net gain is hardly informative to anybody. I think you understand what I'm saying there. Our portfolio is, you know, read the S&P analysis, you know, very well. And those, you know, the real estate, the funny thing happened during the recession. The tenants kept paying. So it kept the yield up on those assets, and they are mark-to-market. They're mark-to-market on a rolling basis. So, Colin, if we sold them, there wouldn't be a big staggering gain because they actually are mark-to-market right now. And that's why we actually took some losses, very minor losses, relative to the size of the portfolio on a real estate last year when the mark-to-markets were in a negative direction. They're coming back now. In fact, we tried to buy real estate at those prices. So we like real estate as a part of a highly diversified portfolio. Warren, do you want to?
You know, I think you've captured all the key points there, Donald. I think the key point is the real estate is, in fact, mark-to-market, whereas the surplus bonds were not. We had to sell them to realize the gains.
Thank you. The next question is from Peter Rutledge from National Bank Financial. Please go ahead.
Hi, good day. I'll be quick because I know it's getting late. Just on the assumption changes, there's $2.8 billion pre-tax this year, $1.9 billion last year, and kind of provokes the question, is it over? And I guess the area of concern that I'd have would be in universal life where, you know, by your own actions, increasing the price 13% would tend to suggest there may be some latent reserve risk. And I wonder if you could comment on that, and could you put any or could you quantify any potential risk as, say, a percent of liabilities backing universal life policies? Thanks.
Peter, it's Mike. I'll start, and I'll ask Cindy to add. On your specific question on universal life, the increases there have been primarily due to the drop in interest rates. And so I would not conclude that there's some correlation between the UL price increases and a coming basis change, you know, other than the second order impact that we mentioned, and that's the ultimate impact on the ultimate reinvestment rate, which in some sense has some correlation. But other than that, we're not aware of anything at this point on the universal life block, and I wouldn't try to correlate it to the rate increases. You know, on your more general question, again, we've got a huge balance sheet, and it's a very complicated portfolio of products that we have actuarial liabilities set up for. So it's not surprising that in any given year there are going to be, you know, changes in those assumptions that get leveraged because these are long duration liabilities. You know, the long-term care is the obvious one that has the uncertainty for all the reasons that Jim Boyle described a few minutes ago. You know, that's one we'll provide updates as we have them. Whether that ends up being a positive or a negative is impossible to tell at this point. We've given it our absolute best shot, including that independent review. Cindy, anything you want to add?
That was a good answer, Mike. Just, I guess, one thing to add is that for universal life, the price increases are on new business, and they're related to the fall in interest rates at, in terms of what we'd be investing new assets at for new business. So no issues with respect to mortality or that sort of issue on the or lapses on the in-force business.
There was certainly some, let's call it risky pricing or risk rating practices in that product line industry-wide over the last couple of years. And, you know, this feels like what we went through with long-term care over the last couple of years. And so it sounds to me like you can't really rule it out.
It's Paul Rooney here, and Jim might want to chime in as well. You are correct. There were some practices in the marketplace. I think you're referring to underwriting practices or aggressive table waiting programs. We did not participate in those. Canada.
Not in Canada, but in the U.S., did you or did you not?
No, you know, I don't think that you're going to see the emergence of, you know, the issues that you're describing in your question. You know, frankly, this quarter we had claims gains in our U.S. life insurance business. You know, we did see some lapse losses in the early duration in the last couple of years, but, you know, we believe that was a bit of an anomaly driven by the economy. You know, we've priced this product with very low lapses, you know, 1.5% grading down to less than 0.5% over time. So we're pretty comfortable with the in-force block.
I'll say the same for Canada.
That's it. Thanks.
All right. Well, thank you, operator. We will be available after the call if there are any follow-up questions. Have a good afternoon, everyone.
Thank you. The conference has now ended. Please disconnect your lines at this time. We thank you for your participation.